Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Our first show of the season. Welcome back one of my favorite guests, Stephen L. Sears. He is a screenwriter, he's a producer, he's an author, he's a graphic novelist. What can't a man do? Hi, Steve.
Well, if you actually want the list of what I can't do, I'll put my girlfriend on the line. She'll be able to actually tell you. It's alphabetical, as a matter of fact. I'm the first show of the season? Seriously? Wow. Wow, such pressure.
Of the seventh season of Chatting with Sherry.
The which season?
Seventh.
Oh, the seventh. Got it. For a moment there, I thought you said final season, and I was going to spend the next 45 minutes talking you out of that.
No. Unfortunately, first show of the season, I have a head cold, so it affects me. Yeah, well, I already told you that.
Yeah, but, well, we'll bypass the sniffles and we'll get over the raspy voice.
Yeah, and not pronouncing certain words as well as I normally do because my nose is stuffed up.
Cool. But then again, all the words you normally mispronounce, maybe you'll say correctly. It's a balance. It's karma.
Ooh, that's a nice switch. I like that. Sort of like Twilight Zone of words.
See, there you go. It's all in how you look at it.
Yeah. So, this is the first show of my seventh season. And in case he doesn't know, when I first started the show and I didn't know what I was doing, I asked Steve if I should do it. He said that I should, so it's all his fault.
Well, put blame where blame is appropriate, but I think you should take full credit for the success of this show. You've done a wonderful job.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate that. But it's interesting because I learn from every guest. I think it's fun. It's hard work, but it's fun.
Mm-hmm.
And I never thought it would go 7 years.
Yeah, well, see, that's kind of the fun thing about these things. You just suddenly wake up and you realize, oh, my gosh, I've been doing all of this stuff. There was a time when I got a letter from the Writers Guild, and I opened up the letter, and when I was reading it, it said that I was in some sort of strange status of writer because I'd been working at that time for 15 years, nonstop. And I was with my current girlfriend, was sitting with me on the couch, and I read through this thing, and I looked at her, and I went, oh, my gosh, I just had a career. I didn't even know it. I was just, like, having fun, you know? So suddenly you wake up and you realize, I've actually accomplished something. Wow, how did that happen?
I think that's amazing. We've talked about your career origins and stuff, but what I'd like to know is you've been a writer for a long, long time. When you look back, what is your most shocking thing that you realize that about being a writer of all different types of genre for this long?
What is the most, what you say, shocking thing?
What surprises you the most? That's a different question.
let me do two qualifiers for everybody out there listening into this. So for both of you listening in. First of all, as Sherry knows, I'm horrible with list questions like what's your favorite or what is the most. It depends on my mood at the moment. They always change. And the second thing everybody should know is that sometimes Sherry and I, when I've done the show, she'll send me a little paragraph or some questions telling me what the questions might be. This is not one of those times. It's completely freewheeling on this one. So you'll hear me do a lot of a lot of stall noises so I can figure out what my answer is. The most shocking thing, and the first thing that shows up in my mind, the most surprising thing, is honestly that I'm doing it. I mean, I know that sounds like, well, of course you're doing it. That's what you do. But for those people out there who have heard my origin story, my own superhero origin story, of getting into the business and becoming a writer, it was totally unexpected, totally unplanned for. I never planned to be a writer. And to this day, quite honestly, I am, you know, still a bit surprised. It happened because I loved it. I was enjoying it. I was having fun. And it's like I mentioned earlier, I read that letter and suddenly I realize, oh my God, I just had a career. I had no idea. I'm still waiting to figure out what I want to do when I grow up. So that still is the most surprising thing. I mean, I don't have the biggest career of everybody. I do have, as far as writing and television, certainly a substantial career. And every now and then I'll look at my resume, and I don't look at it like, you know, with an arrogant pride of, yeah, there we go, that's what I did, ha, ha, ha. I do sometimes look at it and go, wow, how did that happen? So that's probably the most surprising thing. And that also lends into when I talk to classes with aspiring writers or people at different stages of their writing, or I talk to people online, one of the things that I often get back as feedback is how optimistic I am about it, even though it is a incredibly pessimistic career choice because of the odds of being successful. But I try to reflect on that and say, look, if it happened to somebody who had absolutely no intention of this happening, then you, with your perseverance and your talent and your dedication, why can't it happen to you? So I guess that's probably the most surprising thing, that I actually am doing it.
The reason I asked was because of the letter on the couch that you were talking about, and I thought, oh, that's an interesting thing. So that's where the question came.
Well, there you go. Cool.
But, you know, I was thinking about when you were talking, and one of the things, do you ever look at something that you wrote, whether it's a script or one of your short stories or anything that you wrote, and like look at it and you say, I know I wrote it because I recognize my handwriting, but I can't believe I wrote it because I don't remember it. Do you ever look at it like that, or are you ever like, because I've done that. I looked back at some of my old short stories or something. I'm like, I remember writing it, but I can't believe it because I don't remember the story. Does that make any sense?
No, it makes sense. There's a, you know, two things at play for that. First of all, at a certain point, you've just written a lot of stuff. And secondly, for anybody who has done this or even attempted this, you know that you not only have written a lot of different things, each one of those things was written several different ways.
Mm-hmm.
As I try to tell people when I'm writing a 60-page television script, what you aren't seeing is the 800 to 1,200 pages that I wrote just to get there, not to mention all the research that I do. So there's a lot of different variations of it. But, no, there are times when I have read something that I then realize later on, oh, I had written that. There was one case that happened to me a long time ago where I was working at a studio, and I had to go into the accounting office for some reason. I can't remember what it was. And there were two women who were working on computers. They weren't working the front desk, so they were ignoring me. They're just in the background working on computers and doing something. And one of them said, and they did this almost like a sing-song back and forth. One of them said something like, well, plan A didn't work. And the other one, just completely in sync, said, well, time to go to plan B. And the first one said, what's plan B? And the second one says, make plan A work. And then they laughed. And I thought, wow, I've heard that before. What did I see that on? That's a familiar. And then I realized I wrote that. That's from an episode that I had written. So they apparently were fans of a show that I had done. And I was like, oh my gosh, that was actually their tagline back and forth is something that I wrote. So, yeah,
that's
sometimes those are a little bit surprising.
You were on my mind the other day. I was watching I've been watching a show called the 8 Days That Made Rome, and they were talking about Spartacus. And he was talking about how to attack the Romans. And remember the part in Endgame when you had Xena hiding the stuff underneath and attacked them by surprise?
Okay.
It was like Spartacus. Were you inspired by him? Did you know about that?
Well, you know, Spartacus and I were buds. We used to hang out together, worked at the same restaurant. Then he got hired by the Romans and went off and did all that stuff. I research a lot, and that is one of my blessings or flaws or whatever. Well, first of all, that particular case, I'm a history geek anyway. So a lot of the stuff that I put in dealing with history is fairly well researched already. Anything to do with military is probably even more, because that's kind of my focus, military history. So I do research a lot of things. And so when I try to, when I write scripts that have something to do with like that, with, you know, Roman tactics, even in a fictional setting, battle tactics, I will actually try to use things that were actually used, because first of all, they were successful, and secondly, they were just kind of cool. We don't think about them today. But research is one of my banes to my writing, because I will start to research something, and then that becomes my day, is research, because I go off on tangents. One of the things that I try to impress on writers is, because this question came up on one of the writing boards that I pay attention to, how much research do you have to actually do? And for me, I will do, either for characters or for mechanical things or historical things, I will sit there and do just hours and hours and hours of research to write maybe one line or three lines or just have a passing notion about something in a script. And the reason for that is, first of all, I'm a geek with where those things are concerned, but also I need to know that, even if I'm not going to tell you everything about it, but I need to know how it works, how it functions, at least enough to justify what happens in my story. And I was writing a novel, started out as a novella. It's going to be a tome, something called Tomboys that I will eventually finish. But at one point, the lead characters have to hide in a car, and they're being attacked. And I had just written, for some reason, that the car was a 57 Chevrolet Bel Air, just because I kind of like that car. And it was sitting on the side of the road, and when they're attacked, they get inside of the car. Now, to get out of the car, I'm trying to figure out a way to get out, and I think, well, I need to get them into the trunk. And then I thought, okay, can you access the trunk from the back seat of a 57 Bel Air Chevrolet vehicle?
That was
about a five-hour investigation. I now know everything there is to know about building a Bel Air Chevrolet 57.
I saw that in a show, and they pulled out the back seats. Is that what you did?
No, as it turns out, that cars back then were actually built a lot stronger, and they didn't do stuff like that. So I had to come up with another way to get them out of it. But, you know, the funny thing was is that I could have at any time just changed the car. It didn't have to be a 57 Chevrolet Bel Air. I could have very easily have made it a 1992 something, you know, that had that. I should have researched that first. But, like I said, I can now field strip and rebuild a 57 Chevrolet Bel Air, and it has nothing to do with the story. So I'll get off into that. But I just love that. I mean, I'm like an information sponge. I just love that information.
Yeah, we were talking before. I get into these modes where I get into reading about everything that interests me. And sometimes it's about for a story, and sometimes it's just because I'm in this weird mood. Do you have any kind of thing that you like to read and then you get kind of hooked, that you have to read as much of it as you can?
I'm very much a binge person. I like to sit down and just binge through things. It's the same thing with TV shows. My problem reading-wise is getting the time to do it. I read a lot of nonfiction because I can pick that up and put it down. Reading fiction is difficult for me, actually setting aside the time to do it and then to do it continuously. You know, it's really hard to read a novel if you read five chapters one night and then you don't get back to it for 2 weeks. And unfortunately, that sometimes my schedule is like that. So I kind of long for the days that I would just sit down and read a book. And I can think of two books off the top of my head that when I read them, I couldn't put them down. And over the course of the next couple of nights, I read through the entire book. One of them was Peter Benchley's Jaws. The movie was based on that. The original book was a lot different from the movie. Both of them are incredibly good, but for different reasons. And I remember sitting down and reading that, and I just couldn't put it down. I read it for, like I said, straight through, a few days. The other one, surprisingly enough, was L. Ron Hubbard's Battlefield Earth, which I read that back in 1984, I think was the first time. No, actually it was 82. I was staying at, I was moving into a new apartment, and in the meantime I was staying at my friend Bert Pearl. I was staying at his apartment and sleeping on a couch out in the living room. And I don't remember how I got the book, but I opened that up, and it's a pulp book. I love pulp style writing. And that was one. I just could not put that down. And that one's a thick book. That's a really thick book. So I had like 700 to 1,000 pages, and I read through that thing in just like three or four nights. So every time I find something that will do that, yeah, absolutely. I just can't stop. And it doesn't have to be wonderfully well written on a grammatic scale or an academic style. It's how compelling the story and the characters are. That's what draws me through.
I didn't know that Benchley's father was a comedian until my mom told me. I don't remember exactly how the conversation went that way, but she said, "I like the father better than the son." And I go, "Why?" And she goes, "He's so funny. He did a whole series of things." And then when it started coming on TCM, she would call me on the phone. "Sherry, turn your phone on. I mean, turn your phone on. Turn your TV on. It's on now. He's on. The one I was telling you about."
Huh, that's funny. Yeah.
Know about that he was the comedian? His dad?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Did you know that Benchley's father was a comedian?
He was a comedian. He was also a writer, I believe, but it may have been in that particular realm as well. But no,
yeah,
I'm not as familiar with the father.
He was part of the table, what's it called? The one in New York.
Oh, yeah, the round table. Yeah.
Yeah. Can't remember the name of it.
That is true. I do remember that. Mm-hmm. The Algonquin table.
That's it. That's it.
Yeah.
He was part of that with all
Dorothy
the
Parker and a bunch of other people, I believe, were.
In fact, I think he was really good friends with Parker.
Yeah. Now there's a woman that people should read.
Oh yeah. Oh, I
Dorothy
fell in
Parker.
Love with. I read every book I could get my hands on, all of her stuff. She's just fascinating.
Yeah, her one-liners are just incredible. They're absolutely amazing. So, yeah, she's an author.
I'm still saying
that,
today, people don't realize they're referring to Dorothy Parker. How many times I've heard people say things that were one of her lines, and I'm like, oh, that's Dorothy Parker. Who's that?
Yeah. Yeah, and she was just caustic. And her wit and the things that she said and her observations, just absolutely brilliant.
Her and Anita Loos, those were my favorites from that period.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Because she would have that same caustic, witty tone that Dorothy had.
Yeah, what was one of her lines that I liked? Let's see. Time is the great healer, but he's a lousy beautician. One of the ones I thought was kind of amusing. She's just brilliant.
Yeah.
The old-style writers. And to be honest, a lot of the old-style traditional classic writers don't always attract me. And it took me a long time to learn that was okay. You know, like if somebody said, oh, Hemingway is the most wonderful writer, I'm like, well, okay, he's good. I enjoyed reading his stuff, but, you know, it's not like, you know, glorified status. And of course I get crucified for that. But then I kind of realized, you know what? It is so subjective that it's how the writer's work speaks to you. That's another thing I talk to new writers about. I say, look, you know, you're going to be mixed up between writing as an art and writing as a profession. And writing as a profession, you have to be aware of what the audience and the employers are looking for and still preserve what you can of your particular style. Writing as an art, you allow the audience to find you. And a lot of the old-time writers, that's what they did. A lot of the classic writers, they wrote their style and people found them. That's, you know, that was their particular talent and genius.
A lot of times they don't get popular until long after they pass away, like F. Scott Fitzgerald. I mean, he didn't really become popular until the 60s, and he had been gone for like 10 years by then.
Yeah, what's that line from the Stephen Schwartz musical, Pippin? I tried to be an artist, and I found out the only way you know you're good is after you're dead.
It's like a painter.
Yeah, yeah, pretty much. Although, some of our greatest artworks were not written because of strict art. The Mona Lisa was a commissioned work.
That's true. Although he worked on it constantly until the day he died.
I see. That gets to the artist, you know. There's a whole thing about the unhappy artist, and a lot of people think it's because they don't make money. I think the unhappy artist is because nothing will ever be good enough.
Mm-hmm. I think that's
I don't read my stuff. Like scripts I've written or TV shows that I've done, it surprises people that I tell them, no, I don't go back and read my scripts and I don't go back and watch my episodes because I know how perfect they were in my head, and they will never be that way. There are too many choices, too many directions I could have taken. But, oh, well, this is what I ended up with. So the best I can do.
That's what you were talking about. That's the perfectionist of the artist.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Exactly.
And the realism of the person making the money working in the industry.
Well, that is the compromise, and that's a harder thing to do. You know, another one of my little analogies or comparisons to this is if I give you the side of a building and tell you as an artist, as a painter, this is your canvas here. It's huge. And here, I'm going to give you money to go find any color you want and paint whatever you want on there. Well, that can be like true art because the artist has the choice everywhere. But let's say that I come up to you and I say, okay, I'm going to have you paint something for me. And I'm going to give you the canvas. It is only going to be 4 feet by 3 feet. And in fact, I'm going to pick the materials for the canvas. I'm going to pick the wood that actually frames the canvas. And I'm going to pick out the colors for you. And I'm going to tell you what you have to paint. And I'm going to hand it all to you and say, now, make art. Well, can you? Yes, you can. You can. In fact, you have to be more creative because of that. But I tell people, that's actually television. That's what happens in television. You have so many requirements and so many things you have to check off the list to accomplish, and then you are asked to be creative within all of that. You can do it. Very few can do it well. But it is possible.
It's interesting. We talked before about the collaborative art of TV. When you first started, was it difficult for you to work the way you need to work? I mean, I know you started with a spec script for Riptide, right?
No. That was the other Stephen L. Sears you were talking to. I didn't start with spec script. My partner, Bert Pearl, he and I, who were best friends at a restaurant, and we're writing just for the fun of it. We just got together because we were fascinated with the idea of writing. And I won't go through the whole story of how we broke in because we're not going to live that long to hear that story again. But what happened was off of a phone call I had with somebody at the Stephen J. Cannell office who made a suggestion that Bert and I, if we had any scripts, we might send them over to see if the producers would be interested in us. And we had written spec scripts already. We'd written like 5 of them. And so we picked 2 of them and had them sent over. And off of those 2, we got our first meeting. And off of that meeting, we got an assignment. And off of that assignment, we ended up on staff. And that was the beginning of our careers. So back then, now keep in mind, this is the mid-1980s, so things are definitely different now. But back then, television, compared to today, was much more formulaic, much stricter. You only had 3 networks. And those had strict commercial times. You had to write to those. And you could not do serialized dramas, meaning that, like Game of Thrones, as you're telling a novel over several episodes, Back then, each episode had to be a self-contained story that was independent of the other episodes because of the way they syndicated it, and they would air things out of order. The characters continued, but you couldn't have heavy character arcs. So there were a lot more restrictions back then, but you still could create out of that. Also, you know, this was just pure luck. The environment that Bert and I ended up in, the Stephen J. Cannell Productions offices, was the best you ever could have hoped for. Absolutely the best anybody could have hoped for. Steve was a wonderful guy. He was friendly. He was the head of his own company that had four top 10 hits at a time with only three networks. And yet I could just walk down the hallway and duck into his office, say hi to his assistant Grace, and then go in and talk to Steve. There was no problem with that. And the producers I worked with on Riptide was Babs Grahowski and Tom Blomquist were still close friends of mine today. And also I had my best friend, Bert, as my co-writer. I mean, we had such a great little unit and a great family where we were not afraid to be foolish in front of each other. So we were allowed a lot more creativity, and we had a lot more fun at it. So that was kind of special and unique. So is it any different from today? Well, yeah, there's a lot that's different. But today there are other requirements and other restrictions. As I said, you always use Game of Thrones as an example, even though it came from a novel. A lot of really good television is now told in an extremely novelesque, serialized style. And that's a reflection of technology, because we now have streaming. Back in the days of Riptide, if we did an entire season of a series, or whether it was A-Team or Riptide or any of those shows, if you missed an episode, that was it. You had to wait till the summer for the reruns. Mm-hmm. And also, you could come in on the fourth episode, and it didn't really matter. Fourth episode, fifth episode, it didn't matter. But now with streaming, nobody goes to watch a TV series on streaming and says, I'm going to start on the fifth episode. No, they start at the beginning, which means that you as a storyteller can write a huge, heavily involved arc throughout the entire season.
I loved his stuff, by the way. Stephen J. Cannell, all his shows. I loved all his shows.
Steve was a genius.
But I was a huge Rockford fan. I would be always Rockford. Upset if I had to work or something on a Rockford night.
Yeah, and you know, at the time between now and when Rockford was on the air, because I was in college when Rockford Files was actually popular, and I loved Rockford Files. And once again, another surprise that I ended up working with the man who co-created that series. And people forget that when Rockford came out, Rockford, played by James Garner, was the atypical hero. He was an ex-con who didn't want to fight people. He would, you know, he could fight. He absolutely could use his fists, but he wanted to talk himself out of a thing, and he always had a pessimistic outlook. And it was a very humanistic way of looking at a detective. Whereas before that, you had detectives like Mannix and other detectives where they were like, you know, square-jawed and always doing the good thing and above reproach and all this kind of stuff. It was a huge departure and became hugely popular.
I love that. He was the first think before you fight kind of person, and I admired it.
Yeah. In fact, they did a couple of episodes with Lance White, if you remember that. Now, Lance White was the opposite of Jim Rockford. He was perfect. He was just so perfect. And Tom Selleck played Lance White. And the funny thing was about it was that every time Jim Rockford was pessimistic about something, Lance White was just the opposite. He was so optimistic, and he was always correct. I remember at one point one of the guest stars had lost his glasses on the freeway, the Pacific Coast Highway in Malibu, literally while they were driving. His glasses had come off and, you know, flown off into the brush and everything like that on this, like, five-mile stretch of road. And they're over there looking for something else, and the guy is saying, I really want to find my glasses. And Rockford turns to him, he says, you lost your glasses somewhere on the coastline. The odds are you'll never see those glasses again. Get over it. And then you hear Lance White saying, found them. Like everything
that
you saw in the previous, everything that was true in the earlier ways that detectives were played, Steve made fun of it in that episode with Lance White. And it was kind of an homage, actually, because Lance White was cool. You liked him.
Yeah. He was likable, but he annoyed the heck out of Rockford. He just really annoyed him.
Well, of course, because Rockford's life was not like Lance White's life. Rockford didn't always get the girl. Rockford did not always end up with the money. Rockford didn't, you know, wear the nice clothes. And Rockford walked into a room and there were people who automatically didn't like him. Lance walked into a room and everybody loved him.
Oh, and Rockford lived in a trailer and drove an old beat-up
truck. And that is true.
Truck.
Yeah. Yeah, Rockford was me. Oh, boy.
I mean, I was in high school and I adored him. And I'm not going to go into that story, but James Gardner has always been my hero because of a story that happened to me. But
yes. Are you telling that?
He read it in my book.
That's a good story. Yeah,
you.
I think almost everybody who was met, who had met Jim Rockford, James Gardner, they never have a boring story about meeting him.
Mm-mm.
There's always a lively story about meeting him. So
he was a really neat man, James Gardner.
He was a very real person. That was the thing. This has become like the James Gardner show, but he was, and he didn't like the stratified parts of business, or you know, it's kind of like if he was on the set and something needed to be moved, he moved it. It wasn't like, no, we have to call this person, we have to do this, we have to do that. He was kind of like, let's just get it done and move on.
Yep.
But that's, I will also say that's secondhand knowledge. I know people who worked with him. I did not work with him.
I think the best thing to do, because I could talk about him for a while, is talk about your book, Dalek X. We can go on and we could start talking about that. That was
okay.
With Kevin J. Anderson.
Kevin J. Anderson, who? Kevin J. Anderson, for those of you who don't know, is one of the top science fiction writers, a Times best-selling author on several lists, and I've known Kevin for a long time. We became friends. We met at a convention and became friends and always wanted to work on a project together. Kevin was just, he actually just got back from a long trip, but he got like Mexico's highest creative award. They shipped him down there to receive this, you know, this award from the government. I think they actually changed the name of Mexico City to Anderson or something like that. I'm not sure. It was the way he plays it up. but yeah, so I've known Kevin for a long time. He's incredibly well established as an author. And as I said, a lot of people don't even, you know, they hear the name and they're not really sure. He and Brian Herbert write all the Dune sequels that are being done. And I remember when Kevin actually became a part of the game Trivial Pursuits. His name is actually the either the answer or part of the question in one of the cards on Trivial Pursuits. And I called him and I said, you are now famous enough to be trivial.
Oh, my God. That's cool. I didn't know about that. Is that
I know. It's those little things. Yeah. Yeah, he gets to brag about that. I get to brag about the Sears stores closing. Wow. So, don't worry, I don't have stock. But Kevin and I, as I said, we've known each other for, God, I don't know, maybe 20 years. And we'd been trying to put together projects along that way, either some of the, you know, I optioned some of his books. And, you know, trying to get a foothold with those things is really difficult. But we had designed, a long time ago, we came up with the idea of doing a TV series based on a futuristic concentration camp during an intergalactic war. And that morphed into what was just recently published, the graphic novel Stalag X, which you can find in Barnes & Noble, all of your local outlets, and also Amazon.com. And Stalag X is a story, a continuing story, hopefully, about a futuristic interstellar war with a species called the Krayl. And it's a war of genocide, each side trying to wipe out the other, completely destroy the other. And humanity is not winning this war. We're losing it. We are actually losing this war. But it's one of those things, it's a blood war where nobody takes any prisoners, none whatsoever. And our story is around one character who is taken prisoner and then is taken to a concentration camp with other humans, which shouldn't even exist. And there's something about that camp which could unravel the secrets to the war. It's a very gritty novel. It is not a kid's comic book. We, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of my study in history has to do with military history, which includes concentration camps, the Holocaust, Andersonville, those types of places. And we wrote that in. There are experiments being done on humans, and we were very graphic about it. And it's done fairly well. It's published by The Vault, and The Vault did an amazing job in putting it together. It's a hardback book, and it also has a novella in the back of it called Deacon's Story. Deacon is one of the characters. I love Deacon. She's one of the characters, and it tells her story about how she ended up being on this particular planet where this all takes place. It's also gained a lot of interest in my area, in the TV film area. As soon as we started working on it, I got it out there to test the waters. And this is one of those areas where I wish I could mention names, and I can't because of a variety of reasons. But I will say that we have had people on the level of, let's see if I can use an example here. And this is not saying who anybody is, but directors on the level of the Marvel Universe directors and DC Universe directors who have inquired about it. I've had meetings in regard with those people. And right now, Kevin and I are working a document. You see, I'm being careful when I say these things. We are negotiating, or at least we are expecting a what's called a shopping agreement with one of those directors on Starlog X. And I'm not going to tell you who it is because I can't at this particular moment. Right now, it's just basically we're going to have this person wants to take it out and try to package it into an actual series. I thought it would be a movie when I was talking to this person, but this person wants to do it as a series at the moment. We're still in discussions about that. So that's actually very big news. And to be honest, this is the first time I've announced that, but I can't use the name. So I wish I could. Believe me, I wish I could.
Hey, that's a good little tiny hiss there.
And by the way, and for people who don't work in the business, it could still mean absolutely nothing. That is one of the things about this industry. You can have a contract with, you got to have a contract with, Rob Reiner, wonderful, incredible director, to pursue one of your projects and take it out, and he wants to put it together and make a movie about it, and so on and so on, and then it just doesn't happen. That's most of this business is like that. And in fact, I don't know if Dorothy Parker said this or not, but one of our sayings in the business is Hollywood is the place where you can die of hope.
I remember that one.
It's something similar to that. I'm sure I completely bastardized it, but it's something similar to that.
It's
so
a
we'll
good
see.
Line, though.
It's all great stuff. Yeah, it's moving forward. But it's a wonderful book. I mean, I the interior art is done by Michael Datera. And it's very, very striking. You can only deal so much with the subtext and depth in a graphic novel because it's mostly a visual medium. So that took a little while for to adjust my writing style to that. But, that's another example of what you read in that graphic novel is like the tip of an iceberg, to use that well-used and well-intentioned analogy. Because the background material on each one of those characters is in itself a book. And in fact, one of them actually is in the book, the novella with Deacon. So I'm very excited about it.
I am hoping that everything works out, because I read like the first book part of the book.
Mm-hmm.
The first time you guys said, this is the book, and I got that, and then it came out, like, then the graphic novel, and then the different levels, and I like the first one, so I'm sure that the latest one is amazing.
Well, the initially, we had another publisher before this, and initially the first issue was released as kind of a trial. So there were 6 issues originally written by Kevin and I, and all of those are in this one book. So the entire 6 issues kind of tells the basic spine of our story, and then it ends with the, yes, we can continue. Anybody who reads it will say, okay, well, it looks like this is going to go on because there's more adventures to be had here. At the moment, though, we are not working on the second book, except in the very basic outline stage about it. We're kind of waiting to see what happens with this one.
I think that's really exciting, though. That's really cool. Yeah, I know that anything can happen. I've had that happen to myself, so I have my fingers crossed for you.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, it's going along very well so far. And the person we're dealing with right now, one of the better things about this, first of all, it's somebody that I really respect this person's work. I was a fan before we even talked on the phone. But as I said, I had started putting Stalag X out there with my contacts, so you expect some sort of response. And the other people that I can't name who were, you know, interested, they came as a result of that. You know, I made my connections with them. They made their connections with their people and so on and so on. And big names came about. This particular person came about because of the best possible way.
Read it.
This person read the book. This person got a copy of the book and read it. So it wasn't like we were pursuing this person. This person read it and said, no, I like this. And they pursued us.
That's fantastic.
And again, fortunately, it is somebody who, even before this happened, I was a fan of this person's work.
That is amazing. Oh, now I want to see it.
Well, hopefully one day I'll be able to do your show and talk more about that person and how it's going along. But at the moment, it's all part of the business, and it's just it's all one step at a time. Graphic novels is not an area that I am known for. I'm enjoying it. There are this one, and there's one other graphic novel that I co-wrote with Peter Wax, and the artwork was done by Preston Acevedo. But that has not come out, and we don't even have a publisher for that at the moment. It's still in the we formed the first episode with all the graphics and the scripts for it, but we haven't. It hasn't moved forward just at this time.
I've heard about that too. It's amazing. I hope it comes through.
Thank you. I hope it does too, because that'll mean I'm doing something right.
I also, you said you were putting together a book of short stories. How is that going?
As with anything involved with writing. It's like slow and ponderous. I started writing short stories just to kind of test my chops in that area. I've always told people when they say, well, you're a TV writer, I say, well, the truth is I'm a storyteller. I've always been a storyteller since I was a child. Finding the different mediums and finding the venue that works best for me is really what I think is true about most storytellers. So television writing was one that was perfect for me. Screenwriting hopefully is also a good fit for me, but I certainly know the television works. And I just started enjoying writing these short stories. And I also have a couple of novels that are in progress. But one of the things that a friend of mine, another author that I know, suggested to me is he had looked at some of the works that I had written. And he said, you know, you should... He said, if you want to test the waters here, just for the fun of it, why don't you put together a your own book, a collection book of your short stories and put it out? And my reaction was, oh, yeah, authors do that. When they're famous, they do that. When they're well-known and well-established, they put out collections of their short stories, not somebody who is relatively unknown in that area. And he just kind of shrugged and he says, well, why not? Is that a rule? And I kind of went, well, no, it's not a rule, I guess. It's not like I'm doing it for the money. If somebody likes it, great. If they don't like it, oh, well, that's fine. So, yeah, I'm 2 short stories shy of finishing this thing up. And all the stories are fantasy or sci-fi based. Hopefully they just have my quirky approach. The initial readings of them have been very, very good. That's always good. And I enjoyed writing them in the first place. So, and I also experimented with a couple of them. One of them, one of the stories I wrote basically off of a notion that it's Peter Wax and I were talking about this. The idea of writing an entire book in the first person present. Now, you know, for people who don't know this, when a book is written in the first person, it means that the narrative voice you're reading is the character. So a lot of the pronouns are personal pronouns. And, you know, it's like, I remember the first time I woke up and saw his face staring at me. And your entire book is written from that perspective. That's a first person. But almost all books, however, are written in a slightly past present. I had looked out the window. I was walking toward was. It's all past. It's slightly past. It's all the narratives are slightly past tense. So how do you write one that is basically present tense, meaning that everything you're reading is happening at the moment you're reading it in the way the storyteller is telling it? It's very difficult. So I sat down to write one of those short stories. And the entire story revolves around somebody sitting on a bench looking across the street and seeing a chicken walking up the road. And this person is like, I'm going to see this happen. The whole question about why would a chicken cross the road is going to be enacted right in front of me at this moment. And I wrote it for the fun of it, and it completely spiraled out of control, and anybody who reads it will know that it spiraled out of control. But it's called The Road, The Chicken, The Answer, and Life.
I love it. I just love it.
It is one of my more bizarre writings, I will admit that, but I tried to write it. Everything is present tense except for if the character recalls anything from yesterday or whatever, but they're still doing it in the present tense. So anyway, just quirky stuff like that, you know. And I will finish this up, and it'll either go a traditional publishing route or I'll do it as an online publishing thing, probably not through myself. I might take advantage of Amazon publishing. I don't know. It's just doing it for the fun of it.
Sounds cool. Yeah. I'll buy one. You'll have one sale at least.
Okay. Well, I got to figure out if I can get the stories finished. I think right now I have six stories. I need two more, and one of them that I've got to come up with is a sequel or the continuation of one that I've already written. One called Basement. And the entire opening of Basement is actually something that the first paragraph is almost verbatim something that happened to me. So I just kind of spun that into a what if type of question.
I like what if. I think they're fascinating.
I think all writers and all creators have to have a what if. They have to have that genetic code that asks that question, because that's the basis of storytelling. Day-to-day life is day-to-day life. We think of it as boring only because it's day-to-day. Even the exciting parts are not fantasy because they're real. They happen to us. But then you stop and say, but what if? That's the whole basis of telling a story. What if?
Do you think the people who are writers use their imagination differently than the people who are not writers? I mean, is there like this zone that writers live in that other people don't, like a little dream zone or something? This is just a question of mine because I've been trying to figure that out. Because it's hard to explain to someone that I'll have a story idea nibbling at the back of my mind, and if I don't get it down, it'll drive me crazy. And they're like, but that's you. Just tell it to stop. And they're like, you can't tell it to stop. It won't leave me alone.
Yeah, I mean, there is a distinction there. And it's hard for those of us who do that to comment on it, because that's our reality. We live in that. That's our fishbowl. So in other words, I can't really comment on how it's different because it's not different for me. But I also want to add this, because it also, just by saying that, we're kind of like dividing ourselves into those of us who are creative and those people who are not. Everybody is creative. Everybody has a creative gene of some sort in their particular loves and passions that they have, their hobbies. That's when it's most manifested. But, you know, I have a friend who's an accountant, and I've known him for a long time, since high school. and he's an accountant. How exciting can that be? And I asked him one time, and he loves it. He loves being an accountant. And I asked him one time about that because it's not my world. And I said, you know, don't you get bored doing this? And he goes, no, never. I never get bored doing this. And I was like, well, how can you make it exciting? And he says, well, I'm given a stack of papers. I'm given a hard disk of files. And I am told that somewhere in here, something is wrong. And I'm the only one who can find it. And I just started laughing. I went, oh, my God, you're like Indiana Jones.
Exactly.
But you see, but that's it. And he's telling his own little story about this. So everybody has something like that. Now, I can't explain how I'm a storyteller because I was born with that gene. Everybody has it to different degrees. Anybody who's told a joke understands a three-act structure. I mean, that's basic. Three-act structures are a basic part of our storytelling phenomena. That's why they stand out, is a story can have three acts. You know, most of life only has two acts. You're born, you live, and you die. That's it. But events that we tell each other are remarkable because they have a resolution to them. Setup, experience, payoff, or punchline, if you prefer. So with those of us who have figured out a way to tell those stories, the more important thing is that we figured out a way to tell them to other people so other people can identify with them. That's the major part of it. When I write and create, I do go into zones. I am constantly turning the world on its side because I'm constantly looking at the what if. I cannot, as you said, I cannot turn that off. One of the questions I get very frequently is, where do you come up with your ideas? And my response has always been, how can you not come up with ideas? I can't stop it. I can't shut it off. When somebody says, how much time do you spend each day writing? I correct them and I say, what you're actually asking me is, how much time do I spend typing? Because I'm writing 24 hours a day. I can't turn it off. When I'm sleeping and I wake up in the morning, I try desperately to remember things that were in my dreams that I realized pertain to stories. So there was a time when I was paranoid that I'd stop coming up with stories. I really was. I was so paranoid. And then I realized, you know what? I'm never going to stop doing this because it's me. So there's a better one around the corner. I can't stop saying what if.
That's just part of, I think most people are like that, though. I mean, not the what if the writer, but just there's some creative urge. And like you said, everybody's creative. My grandfather was a great gardener. He was really creative with plants and flowers and stuff like that. That was his creativity. My mom did needlepoint, and it was like tapestry. Everybody has their own thing. My brother's a great cook. He doesn't think he's creative, and I keep saying, yes, you are. You put all your creativity in your cooking. Everybody's creative.
Yeah, everybody has that. The key is, where is it focused? And that's usually determined by your loves, what you actually love doing. And then the next step, which is the least creative aspect of it, is how can I monetize this? That's the area that becomes the most difficult. But I think that the creative state of being always exists, but if you want it to be a continuous thing, you have to have that programming in your head that says, I have to question everything. It's like when my photography, one of the compliments I've gotten on my photography, which is a hobby, is that I can find a message in my photos. Sometimes I'll just take a wild photo, and then when I look at it later on and I can crop and focus on something, I'll find a story in that. And somebody one time told me that my photography was, he phrased it as walking through life backwards. And I thought, I thought that was kind of like, are you trying to slam me? What does that mean? And he said, no, everybody walks forward, and what they see coming at them is what they accept, and they walk by. If they were to stop and turn around and look at where they just came from, they would see the other side of life. And that's more fascinating. And I thought, wow, that's cool. I'll take that compliment.
Well, just your pictures of Julian, you know, like the one you had where he was on the porch and all you see is like his nose.
Yeah. Julian, warrior puppy. Julian's
that
actually
cool.
Sitting under my, he's under my chair right now. He doesn't know we're talking about him.
Julian is his dog, the most beautiful dog you ever saw. I love him.
He is cute. Yes. I will not deny that he is cute. Eventually, hopefully, he'll have his own web page. Actually, truth is, if you go to warriorpuppy.com, you can actually see a picture of him. That's how obsessed I am with my dog.
He has his own Twitter account.
He does. He doesn't do a lot of talking on there. The whole opposable thumb thing is a problem. But, yeah, he used to actually post quite a bit on that. Yeah, maybe he'll get back to it.
He's so cute. I only got to meet him in person once, but we connected.
Of course. I would expect no less.
We're coming to the end. I just wanted, is there anything coming up that we haven't gone over that you want to let people know about?
A couple of things. One, completely general. As I said, I am working on some new projects. Not just developing some ideas for television or film. I mean, I didn't disappear after I did my last show. I went into development, which is a more difficult realm for a number of reasons. And so I'm still working on that. I don't have a show on the air, obviously, and I'm not the way the shows are structured right now, and the fact that I'm considered to be an old fogey at this particular point. I'm not the most staffable person in the business. That's just a reality. But I still work on my development and work on different projects and for money as well. But the novels have been fascinating me. So there will be novels released. Tomboys is one of them. The Adventures of Harry O'Fell, that's another one that I want to finish. Eventually, there's another one, which I forgot the name of it, and then there's the collection. Those are all being worked on at the same time. I do still make appearances at conventions. I also appear at different schools every now and then. I'm invited as a guest speaker. I'm always happy to do that. I did my first signing first talk and signing at a library, actually, just a few months ago at the St. Augustine Library in St. Augustine, Florida, where I donated a couple of my books, including my book on the television industry, The Non-User-Friendly Guide to Aspiring TV Writers, which is still out there and doing quite well. So those things are still going on with me. And then as far as other things that I think are of interest is the fact that this is the first episode of the 7th season of Chatting with Sherry. That is awesome.
Is.
And we
it
have
is.
An entire season coming up of stuff and of people
year
that we're going to be hearing about.
A whole year.
And I'm going to find you some more people, too, because I actually had somebody else recently approach me and say, do you think Sherry would want to talk to this person? And I was like, yeah. So I have some other names I'm going to throw at you.
Yeah, absolutely. You know I'm always open to that.
Well, you've got a few of my friends on there, which is pretty awesome.
I know. They're all awesome.
One of them, you had Thunder on there. Thunder was on recently, right?
Yeah, he was up toward the end of last season.
Yeah, Thunder Thunder Levin. Thunder, I hope I'm pronouncing your last name correctly. I've never actually had to say it out loud. Thunder is an amazing writer in his own right, and his notoriety, whether this is good or bad, his notoriety is as the original writer for Sharknado, for those movies. But, Thunder and I have actually been talking about working on something together. We thought it would be kind of amusing to saying, you know, like the man who brought you Sharknado and the man who produced and wrote Xena together in something that is completely unexpected. So we've talked about working on something together. He's pretty cool.
That sounds like a really cool idea. They bring you a girl story.
Yes. a story of our times or sometime, but you know, something that's fun, wild, out there, and still grounded. He and I, our problem is we get together for lunch to talk about story and everything like that, and we end up just basically chatting about life and about his Jeep. So, but he's pretty cool. And, he was, we had a little chat with him. So hopefully he and I will be putting something together. So we'll see. Other
yeah,
stuff.
I'd like to have him come back this season.
Cool. Yeah, excellent.
I'd love that. And Brooks?
And Brooks Wachtel, you know, there's so many people that are have been very meaningful and pivotal in my career. And Brooks Wachtel, for those of you who don't know, is an Emmy Award-winning writer and producer and documentary filmmaker and animation writer and producer. In fact, that's, he won his Emmy in animation, animation writing. And I met him back on the strike line for the Writers Guild strike several years ago. And then later on, I was dealing with a particular studio where I went in to pitch an idea for a live-action series. And this was a studio that also did animation. And I walked out with, instead of, I sold that pilot to them, and I sold two other pilots, completely unexpected. And the other two were animation pilots. So I had a three-pilot deal with the studio. Two were animation, one was live-action, and I knew nothing about animation. So I called Brooks and I said, will you tell me what I'm supposed to do? So Brooks very graciously helped guide me through that process. So, yeah, he's wonderful. He always has great stories. And people don't know this, he is also a teacher at the UCLA adjunct series. I believe that's correct. Basically, he teaches animation writing and writing in general. He's an awesome guy. And he's a magician at the Magician at the Magic Castle.
And he's really, really smart. He writes like a little history blurb on his Facebook page every day.
Well, a lot of his documentaries had to do, obviously, with history. You know, a lot of them military history, so he and I connect on that. The TV series Dogfight, which was popular about 10 years ago, hugely innovative because it recreated dogfights using computer technology. That was one of his creations. He created that.
That was one of my favorites. I loved the ones from the World War One. I forgot what they call them, but the planes with the dogfights from the old World War One. I see the pants what he did. Really fascinating.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, he's a cool guy. He is a lot of fun. So yeah, you've had some good people on there.
Steve has been very supportive of my show.
What's that?
You
broke up there just a second.
My nose. I said Steve has been very supportive of my show. He helps me.
Yeah, it's a fun show.
All the time, and I really appreciate it.
No, it's a fun show, and you have a very disarming way of talking to people, so we reveal all of our secrets to you and then regret it later on.
I'm just me. I don't know about disarming. I'm just myself.
Yeah. Well, hey, that's the brilliance of it. That's how evil you are. I'm just being me. Yeah. I have another friend whom I will give a shout out to named Shane Siders, and Shane is, people say that she is the most networking person you will ever run into, which is true. She just networks wonderfully, and she is also a writer, animation writer, comic book writer. She does a lot of good stuff. And she will deny it. She'll say, no, I'm just being me. I'm like, well, that's you. You just like, everybody likes you. I don't know why, but everybody likes you. It irritates the people like me who have to work for it. But everybody likes you. So she goes, I don't know. I'm just being me.
Show too. You introduced me to her too.
Do what? Yeah, she did a show.
You introduced me to her too.
That's right.
She was on my...
Yeah. No, I try to get you all, at least, you know, give you a list of people you can approach, and hopefully it all works out. So far, it seems to have.
Yeah.
But these are all people, you know, I've been very fortunate to have met them or worked with them. And I think one of the overall things that people should learn from this is you hear about Hollywood being so cutthroat, and we walk on each other's spines, and we'll screw everybody, we'll stab you in the back. And you know what? That happens in every business, every career. You're going to have to deal with that. But most of what my career has been, and we're talking 35 years. Yeah, holy crap. 35 years I've been doing this. I've managed to surround myself mostly with really wonderful people. And we care about each other. We don't look at it as competition. And even the people I've worked with who are difficult and who have bad reputations and are known for being assholes, quite honestly, there's not one person I can think of that I wouldn't work with again, because even when you know that about somebody, that's fine. You can just toss it off as long as you're confident in yourself and what you can bring to the table. But the vast majority of people I've worked with, we all kind of liked each other. So, you know, it's not quite as bad as everybody thinks.
I think that's great. I want to thank
you. Or I'm
you.
Totally delusional, one or the other, but I don't care. It's still working out for me.
I want to thank you, not just for coming on this show, but for being so supportive for all these years of the show. Like you said, you've helped me find guests. You've been on my show every season. You come on my show more than once.
Well, I don't know if that's helping your ratings, but, yeah, I'll fill the space. I have no problem with that. Getting me to talk never seems to be a problem, as people have figured out.
Well, you have a lot you can say, so that's cool. And I like to talk to you, so obviously.
Well, thank you.
So, thank you.
We just love each other. Isn't that so wonderful?
Anyway, thank you for being on the show again. Thank you for being part of being my friend. I sound like I'm going to start singing the Golden Girls theme. Really, I do appreciate you, Steve, really.
Well, not a problem. We always have fun when we chat. Because we
Me
always
too.
Have fun when we're chatting with Sherry.
See, he's sneaky. Anyway, thank you very much, Steve.
Thank you.
And thank you for chatting with Sherry.
Ta-da!